special treat for the chair to have Senator Rohde and Senator Hufford and Senator Pierce and Senator Simansky here. And we are in total a full committee. The first bill that we have before us is going to be committee substitute for House Bill 118 Judiciary from the Senate side. And let the record show, please, that Commissioner Hugh Malone has entered a statement into the record. It's a page and a half. All of you have that, and I appreciate the commissioner entering his statements in writing for the record and not taking committee's time for oral testimony. Do I have a sign-up sheet? Thank you very much. Steve Mahoney.
My name is Steve Mahoney. I'm a senior tax attorney for Arco Alaska, Inc. I would like to do the same as the commissioner and present written testimony in the form of a letter to yourself, Chairman. And unless there are questions, I will yield the floor.
Oh, Mr. Mahoney, that's very, very nice of you. Are there questions for Mr. Mahoney from the committee? Again, for the record, Arco Alaska, through Mr. Mahoney, is entering statements into the record in writing. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Jerry, Serena.
Madam
Hello,
Chairman,
I
won't make it quite as easy, but I don't think I'll take more than a minute and a half of your time.
Are you going to mention your company's name?
Yes. For the record, my name is Gerald Serena, and I'm a tax lawyer with Exxon Company USA. I appreciate the opportunity to present Exxon's views on the question of retroactivity of House Bill 118. We want to make it clear at the outset that we continue to oppose House Bill 118, but we're speaking today just on the retroactivity aspect. We believe that the version of HB 118 passed by the House on March 22nd has only prospective application, and if it were to become law, it would apply 90 days after enactment in accordance with Article 2, Section 18 of the Alaska Constitution and Alaska Statute 01-10070. The issue of retroactivity of HB 118 was specifically addressed by the House Resources Committee during its hearing on February 28, 1989. Assistant Attorney General Richard D. Monkman testified at that hearing. The Resources Committee had before it Mr. Monkman's March 31, 1988 memorandum on the subject of ELF retroactivity involving earlier ELF legislation. Mr. Monkman opines therein that, quote, without passage of the effective date clause by a two-thirds vote, the retroactive application section will be void and the bill will operate prospectively only. The Resources Committee passed out a substitute bill for HB 118, which would have retroactive application beginning January 1, 1989. The committee substitute had both an express statement of retroactive application and an immediate effective date. This was the version voted on by the House on March 22nd. The bill passed 21-19. However, the immediate effective date, which required a two-thirds vote, failed 26-14. In a February 27, 1989 House Resources Committee memorandum, the committee co-chairmen state their conclusion on this issue as follows. Quote, in summary, the law requires that to be retrospective, a statute must specify that it is retrospective, and there must be a two-thirds vote for an immediate effective date. This understanding was implicit in the final House Resources Committee substitute. The confusion arises because the failure to get a two-thirds vote in the House resulted in deletion of the immediate effective date provision only, Section 8. Sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 dealing with retroactivity were left in the bill. We submit that this was inadvertent and that Sections 4 through 7 without Section 8 are superfluous and of no effect. Thank you. This concludes my testimony.
Questions to Mr. Serena? Senator Simansky.
Can you, were you at the previous hearing?
Previous hearing
on this subject?
Of this committee?
This committee?
No, I wasn't.
Probably the only issue that's going to be dealt with in this committee is this issue of retroactivity. But it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that if we were to pass the House bill and in its current form and the effective date, sent it to the House and it concurred and passed an effective date, then it would become law as originally drafted. Is that correct? And would you see any problem with that?
I don't think I follow the scenario. If you pass the bill that's
we pass the bill the way it is?
Right.
And the effective date?
We've adopted the CS.
There is no effective date, I don't believe, in that bill.
We've adopted the CS. We've taken out all the retroactive
His mute question is still correct.
Senator Szymanski's question is correct. That would happen if we adopted the original House bill and we added the effective date and the House concurred in that, yes, sir. We could do that.
The question has been addressed, though, Madam Chair, because then the question is, did the Senate, in fact, amend the bill if we just passed their original bill with the effective date? And that was one of the cases that went with ARLF funding in about 1982 and went all over the place. I'm not sure what the final disposition is. Because it may be held that the bill should not go back to the House for concurrence because the effective date is not an amendment, and therefore it'd be transmitted. With the Senate having passed an effective date, the House having failed, the effective date would be taken out and enrolling and not be there. So you don't know whether it would really get back to concurrence. If you change something else.
So that they, let me ask you this. The previous committee's action to adopt the CS was not based on a flaw that's in the bill. It was a policy call and retroactivity. Is that correct?
It was both a policy call and the fact that we had conflicting legal opinions as to the meaning of the missing effective date. So we eliminated the problem by eliminating the retroactivity clauses. It's not a non-issue in the CS.
But it would still be a non-issue, according to Senator
Halpert. It's not a clean path, it's a possible path.
It was my intent, essentially, to make a policy decision not to deal with retroactivity when I moved for the adoption of CS taking out this section.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Serena? Do you have something in writing for us?
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else in the room wish to testify on committee substitute for House Bill 118 Judiciary? We'll close the public hearings now. What are the wishes of the committee? Senator Hopper?
Can we motion to move it on?
Yes, sir. Unless there's a question or comment.
I move that we pass out Judiciary Committee substitute for House Bill 118 with individual recommendations.
Hearing no objections, Senate CS for House Bill 118 Judiciary is moved for committee with individual recommendations. Thank you very much. Next we have SJR number one. Senator Rohde was very kind to go over Senate Joint Resolution number one and to do some research on it. We had had a message from the previous committee that there were some possible constitutional problems with this, with the fact that the legislature was giving up its immunity in this particular case. So I asked Senator Rohde if he would go over the bill and do some research with us, and he's ready, has announced that he's ready to report the bill back to the committee for discussion. Senator Rohde, sir.
Madam Chairman, on the immunity issue, I think the summation of the matter is that the legislature can do what it wishes in terms of a constitutional amendment. If it wishes to surrender its immunity, it can propose a portion of that question to the public, amend the Constitution, and the matter is resolved by the public. The only I had one word change in the bill, and I take a second to get the.
Committee will stand at ease briefly, please. Back door, please, Senator Rohde. You are with your proposed CS,
yes,
you not, sir?
The original language was willful, there for a willful violation. I propose that we insert the word intentional. The difference is slight, but I think intentional is a better. It would be possible to have a willful violation without it being intentional, and I want to ensure that while intentional violations are dealt with, that, if something happens, that there be an excellent intent to have it be not one that would happen by accident, such as over a dinner where something was discussed.
We have the prime sponsor with us today. You have a proposed CS before you, which changes the word on lines 21-22 from willful to intentional. We won't move that CS quite yet until we hear from the prime sponsor. Senator Strzelczyk, I've noticed, I read the League of Women Voters legislative newsletter. Mm-hmm. I've read a letter from, I believe, the legal counsel of the folks working on the initiative process. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that they were unhappy with the wording of the legislation. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can address some of those things and talk to the committee, and I'll turn it over to you.
Good.
And it's good to have you here.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you. You've lots on your plate today, so we'll try and be responsive but not too long-winded.
No, let's do what
fine.
You feel comfortable.
Fine. I'm just having staff copy a proposal that I might make to you for your consideration in response to the League of Women Voters letter. But first of all, in terms of the change proposed by Senator Rohde, he was kind enough to work with me in his review, and I think that's fine. Willful apparently does not have a specific legal connotation, so I would appreciate your adopting the committee substitute. I'm in full agreement with that. Two things that were raised.
Mr. Campbell is welcome to join us at the table.
Fine, would you like to join us? But you're having those copies made.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Campbell is staff to Senator Strzelczyk joining us at the table.
If I could, I don't know if you should have been made aware of the letter from the Committee for an Open Legislature. This was from the Cheryl Shamlin, who is the Scanlon, who's the League Representative for the Committee for an Open Legislature. She talked about two
Excuse me,
areas. Sorry,
just one moment. Does everyone have that letter?
Where is it?
It came in after you had the packet. If I could read the portion.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, ma'am, please.
There's,
fine.
Yes, I believe we have.
No, that's a different.
This,
that's a different.
This is not Scanlon's letter.
Could I see? Can I see yours?
That's it.
Oh, that's
previous
not
letter.
Yet.
Yeah, I thought it was.
All right, we'll get a copy of that. But if I could read the for you, if I could read the pertinent part. We need to stress that we strongly support keeping language regarding judicial voidability of bills passed as a result of closed meetings, that all substantive deliberations be held in open meetings, and that all possible groups or subgroups of the legislature involved in meaningful legislative discussion be held in open meetings. If we could discuss the first point regarding the judicial voidability of bills passed as a result of closed meetings. It basically, can the whole budget, if there was a violation, could the whole budget be voided because there had been a breach of the thing? And I think that I would strongly urge that we do not do that. I think it's really draconian. I think that a limit on the amount of civil fines can be established by the legislature. The reason this amendment prohibits the invalidation of legislation is that it's so so strong, could create such hardship, such difficulty in a number of cases, that it's not going to just penalize those individuals that are involved, it's going to really could have serious impacts on the whole public, the ability to deliver services. In other words, it goes so far. There could be legislation, for example, that had a whole number of public hearings, for instance, the marijuana bill. And because there was one meeting held, it could just throw that whole thing out. So I think it goes far too far. That would be my response to that issue. In the question of subgroups, and that had been in an earlier version, as you know, this thing has evolved as it's gone along. But you'll see that in section 24, it talks about private and substantive discussion or debates on legislation under its jurisdiction by a quorum of the House of the Legislature or of a committee are prohibited. Now, in our ability to carry out through statutes additional information, you could address the issue. It's broad enough, so you could have subcommittees brought under. But what I did is to have drawn up a piece of legislation that would actually speak to that issue. I'd like to hand it out if I could so we could discuss that. And to me, the reason that we did not include it was when you get into so many subcommittees are three members. And so we didn't want to do something that would keep this normal flow of business operating.
Senator,
and,
excuse me, did Senator Rohde have a chance to discuss this language with you?
No, we have not gone over this with Senator Rohde.
Okay, great.
All right, if you would take a look at the proposal, the pertinent parts, we just had this in further reflection, if that would come up and be a consideration of the committee. If you would take a look here, what we've done in Section 24, and it speaks specifically to the subcommittee issue, except as provided in B and E, and then it goes on through the legislation, you could read it. It adds the word on line 14, or subcommittee. But by providing B and E, it very clearly states that the section, that is E on line 24, the section does not restrict discussion between two legislators. So it gets us away from that problem of where you have a three-member subcommittee. And that's really where the problem is. It's not a question of a five-member committee or seven or nine or other multiples. It's just that when you've got two people, you should have an opportunity for discussion. So I would have no objection at all in seeing this addressed, if that's the desire of the committee.
And I notice you put the word intentional in there rather than willful.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So just to recap for the committee, you've heard this prime sponsor's debate on this, and we do have other people to testify. What you will have before you then is two proposed CSs, and at some point today I would want a motion on which CS the committee would like to adopt and proceed with the legislation. Senator Szymanski, you have a question.
Thank you. I appreciate the sponsors addressing that concern, but it's one of the concerns. I embrace the concept.
Mm-hmm.
The concern I have is a five-member committee, and the Senate is a difficult body to deal with. But
the
let's
Senate's
use
not difficult to deal with.
Let's well because of the size and because you can have committees. Most committees in the Senate are five, generally five or
five
in that neighborhood.
Seven,
but
yeah.
Let's take the Rules Committee, five.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take the example. Let's take the leadership of the Senate sits down, and the Rules Chairman, the President of the Senate, and one other member of the Rules Committee meet in his office to talk about an adjournment, and they discuss the scheduling of bills. Would that be substantive discussion that should be open to the public?
Mr. Campbell, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Szymanski, no, that would not be made open under this. What this requires is that specific legislation, if there is discussion and debate on the merits of a particular piece of legislation, then that would have to be open. In other words, if there's consideration about, well, we like this bill, but it has a problem here in 2B, Section 2B, and we need to change it to say this, or it's going to cause us a problem, that clearly would have to be open. But it doesn't matter how many senators you get together, they can talk about anything else in the world they want, as long as they don't cross that threshold.
Madam Chair, through the Chair.
Yes, Senator Strzemski.
If you'll remember way back when this started, we had tried to write in the ability, one approach had been that you could have strategy and organizational issues outside. This bill allows that without referring specifically to the word strategy. It does allow it by limiting the coverage of this to the private substantive discussion or debates on legislation under, you know, specifically the legislation, as Mr. Campbell has talked about. So those kinds of strategy sessions would be allowed under this legislation. That's something we spent a lot of time on with legal counsel.
Senator Halpert.
Well, this session is an example of something where we don't see the Finance Committee discussing having a lot of open substantive discussion, but what we see is a group of three people, the presiding officers and the two co-chairmen, meeting with the governor. Do you think those meetings should be open? And do you think all the meetings of that summit group should be open meetings?
Just trying to see how that would... I'm looking at the legislation as opposed to what my personal feeling would be. Again, I would assume that would come under the strategy approach. certainly dealing with anything specific has to be in, would have to be in public. You know, with specific, the kinds of things that we would object to, say the setting of caps, the setting of any kind of numbers, all of those clearly would have to be out in public.
Well, the governor is meeting with those people and asking them, can you support a bill to change the rules of collective bargaining? Can you support a bill? I mean, that certainly changes the rules of everything that
mm-hmm.
happens. Can you support a bill to deal with permanent fund income? Can you support a bill to do this or do that? And they're responding as to whether, number one, they can support it personally, and number two, would they advocate it and try and collect the votes to get it done? I mean, that seems to me to be much more a matter of public concern than two members of the DEC subcommittee discussing the DEC budget. Or three members of the subcommittee.
Again, it's, you know, you don't have the specific bill before you. You're talking about a pre-event, and the law indicates once there's something in the process, some specific piece of legislation that you're dealing with. And I'm not, Mr. Campbell, do you have any additional comments on that? I don't think, because you're not talking about a specific bill.
Madam Chair.
Please,
I'm not going to address the issue of whether or not those should be open. I will address the fact there would not be, under the scenario that you raised, if I am correctly understanding that you're talking about the members of the chairs of the Finance Committee and perhaps the chairs of each respective body, the President and the Speaker, meeting with the Governor. They are not affected. A meeting of such type would not be affected by this amendment. We did not try to address every problem that exists in the world, and it may be that through public pressure or policy or whatever, those types of meetings will be open through, you know, because of political reasons. But to reach that meeting, you would have to reach so many other types of meetings that I think you clearly would not want to, and casual groups and everything else. I don't believe it is possible to craft legislation that would require such a meeting to be open without it being extraordinarily onerous.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand the point you're making. That was part of the problem, Senator Halford, just in discussing the whole issue of strategy and how you're going to, you know, in the case of the Senate, how do you bring the organization to the legislature to a close? How do you, in the caucus, what are the issues that are appropriate to have? And so there's a whole range of things that you could be the what ifs. And I'm not saying that there are not public policy issues, that there are not rights and wrong, but what you wanted, or what the intention of certainly myself in sponsoring this, that when you have specific issues before you that are going through, that you don't just go off in a room and decide on those and, in a sense, abort the public process. Whatever the result, I would think, of strategy meetings, not on specific legislation, but overall strategy, has to go through a legislative process. So I think that's where we were aiming for the protection.
Senator
Simansky. Oh, thank you. Senator Zelensky, I guess I go back to your remarks. And I use the example again of the Rules Committee and the way we know how the Rules Committee has traditionally worked toward adjournment, where discussions are held between the leadership. And when somebody makes a decision whether or not a bill will or will not come out of that Rules Committee, that's a pretty substantive decision on policy, because individuals' lives or issues balance as to whether or not that bill. Now, if three people in the leadership make that call in a private room or a private discussion, it seems to me then the person or persons affected by a bill that does not move certainly should be able to subpoena and bring a suit, a violation against the three parties, and compel you to testify. And again, going back to Senator Rohde's concern with regard to immunity, at that point in time, compel you to come forth and ask you to be deposed on the discussions, whether or not they were not substantive. Do you agree that that scenario could exist?
Through the chair, there's a lot of things that obviously could happen. What we have now is a situation that nothing that we do, any breaches, cannot be covered. And this law is pretty specific as to what it covers, that it does not, in fact, cover the strategy thing. If you brought in strategy, I think you would bring the whole system to a grinding halt, that the system would not work at all. So there's a balance as to the free flow of information between legislature and the absolute prohibition of ever talking about anything. So you're not talking about the specifics as much as how does this impact the overall. You're talking about, in the broad sense, a piece of legislation and how that fits into the whole scheme of reaching a desired point, which might be the closing of the legislature or moving things forward. And that's entirely different than specific legislation.
Would you address the latter part of my question associated with immunity? And the original premise by which immunity was granted to the legislature was that it would not be used as a tool by any individual or groups to interfere with the process. Mm-hmm. And let me suggest that, let's say the other body mm-hmm. was to suggest that three members of a particular committee had met to discuss the stoppage of a bill, and they decided they want to go to suit under that and compel them to come into court. It seems to me then at that point in time, the litigation and our ability to have immunity could be used as a tool to interfere with the process from one body versus another, even an outside body. And let me just throw mm-hmm. out a goofy one, call this ELF.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say one group decided that they wanted to compel, and they felt that there was a conspiracy amongst three members of the legislature mm-hmm. to deal with a substantive issue.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be, under your interpretation, if this was enacted today and this was on the books, that a concerned group could bring charges? If it was felt that the three legislators of the committee met and discussed this issue in a substantive manner?
If they, well...
Outside of a public meeting.
Outside of a public meeting, I think that would clearly, if there was private and substantive discussions or debate on the legislation under its jurisdiction, that would be, by a quorum of the House of the legislature of a committee or subcommittee, would be prohibited. I think that's
pretty clear.
Then.
But with regard to compelling them to respond in the immunity question, which could potentially be an interference with the process, do you see that as a problem?
Madam Chair, could we again go to Mr. Campbell?
Certainly, Mr. Campbell.
Madam Chair, Senator Szymanski. I think there are two questions you raised. One is how legislative immunity factors into this, and two, whether a suit could be used as a device or a tool to disrupt the legislative process. And I think those are both serious concerns, and they're concerns that we have discussed at some length and hopefully successfully addressed. In the intent on this bill, one of the things that it says is, that this is... amendment provides a basis for judicial enforcement. I'm in Section B on the second page. Or of the existing open meetings law, or an amendment to the extent the provisions are consistent, notwithstanding Articles 6 and 12 of the Constitution. One of those is legislative immunity. We've held extensive discussions with legal services on this issue. What this amendment does is it does permit legislators to be civilly fined and be compelled to respond in a suit, et cetera, regarding open meetings. It opens a very small window in legislative immunity, and without that immunity, quite frankly, there's no point, there's no method of enforcement, but it also very strictly limits that window in immunity by being very specific, for instance, that the court may not impose rules, may not get into anything other than what is prescribed. On the issue of could a court or suit be used as a disruptive tactic? I think there are two things here. One is, there probably could be such an attempt. I would point out, though, that in the history of Alaska, and we have had one form or another of open meetings law on our books since statehood, there are not just the state government, but 166 municipal governments, a myriad of boards, commissions, et cetera, all of which meet under open meetings law, and there is simply no history, not one example of a frivolous open meeting lawsuit. And the fact is, the numbers of open meeting lawsuits you can count on less than your fingers. So there's simply not a history of that. And the third thing is if this is an issue that the legislature is concerned about, and I think it's a legitimate issue, it is, and we've also discussed this with legal services, it is entirely within the prerogative of the legislature by implementing legislation, for instance, to say any open meetings lawsuit will be stayed until the legislature adjourns and then the court will take it up, that there won't be any compelling of testimony or anything else while the legislature is in session. He said, under this amendment, that is entirely within the prerogative of the legislature.
But the one house that wants to use it in a house-to-house disagreement, as Senator Szymanski said, of course stops the legislation from passing that would allow you to stop action on use during the legislative session.
In the case of a suit.
In the case of a lawsuit, right. Unless you have it tied together with the amendment, then the room is there to go forward and do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Halford, I suggest that could be the case if you waited until the time that such a disagreement arose to file such legislation. What I would suggest would be a more prudent course is to find out, for this amendment to proceed, to find out what its final form is in passage, because it has evolved. I think this is draft number 44, if I'm not missing my count. And then when you see what the final form is, write implementing legislation. I think you're engaging in exercise and frustration if you try to write implementing legislation as it goes along. But I do think you should do it as soon as you get something in the final form.
When you get to 48, you'll meet the railroad. Senator Halford, further comments?
Well, I'm just a different topic. Legislative immunity is a funny thing. It's been used by members of the body to avoid prosecution for some interesting things in the last decade. And yet we're not allowing for the invalidation of legislation. And, you know, I wouldn't say that we should have some kind of a flat rule that invalidates legislation automatically if there's a violation of the Open Meetings Act in its consideration. But to say that can't be a remedy right in the face of this constitutional amendment really seems to be taking away the one most obvious redress for the victim of a closed conspiracy. For example, a lobbyist gets a group together and figures out and puts a deal together, and that deal is very damaging to one or the other side of one of these equations that we continuously have, whether it's mariculture versus non-mariculture, whatever it is. The people that are on the losing side, they can prove all those facts, they can figure it all out, but they can't invalidate the legislation, and as a result may be bankrupted by a negative act of the legislature that was clearly a constitutional violation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chair, I think that those things could happen. There's also the very strong feeling, and I think a wise one, that you need to be very, very careful about the whole question of the immunity issue. And if we go too far, you'll never, in my opinion, because people feel so strongly about that, if it's not narrowly defined, you're just simply not going to get the support that allows the public, rightfully, to come forward when there is a case of a breach. And by getting the issue out, by bringing the lawsuit, by, even though there may be just a civil fine, the issue is brought forward for all the kinds of things that we get through the public press. It's not just the one thing that the law accomplishes and what you get for it. I think you have to weigh that. You're going to have the public notified, you're going to have the press notified if there's a suit brought, and there's going to be scrutiny to that suit. But to put something in that might throw out an entire budget or a major thing could do such harm to the system that I think in the side of just the system working, that you can't go that far. And I think there's a balance that's going to have to be reached on this.
Further discussion? Senator Hopper, you may continue, then Senator Stransky and Senator
With regard to the immunity, I'm not as I don't feel the way some people do on the immunity. I think the immunity only should cover what we say while we're essentially discharging our duties. And anything else, we should be prosecuted just like any other citizen of the state. I think immunity has been abused more than it's been used to the benefit of the state.
But that is an issue that's been discussed a number of times before this. I think one of the major things in Mr. Gross, another presentation, and it is an issue of concern, I think, to legislators. It's that prerogative again. And so I do think it is a major issue.
Senator Simeon.
Going back to the sponsors, CS, for a moment, the committee or subcommittee legislature prohibited the subcommittee of finance, the three-member finance subcommittee. And traditionally, when you have majority-minority,
mm-hmm.
a little more sparsely
mm-hmm.
broken, you have two majority members, one minority member on,
mm-hmm.
on subcommittee. The subcommittees traditionally write the budget. What you're saying then is the majority members of a subcommittee of finance can meet, and they're not excluded.
The majority members.
Two majority members of the subcommittee of finance can meet, and they are not excluded or prohibited from writing the budget in secrecy.
Madam Chair, that's a reason, Senator, that the issue of three-member subcommittees is very difficult. If you were to bring that totally under and not allow for that kinds of things, I'm thinking of the revisers bill that you just sent off to a committee. Well, I think that we've had a little subcommittee of two for a number of years. Senator Josephson and I had that, or a couple of years, had that task. Well, we went off, we got the information, we reported back to the full body, and so on. If we had a just subcommittee and no ability for us to converse, we could not have done, in a sense, the public meeting without going through the whole notice and all of the other process. You're a subcommittee of two, and you meet in the stairway, or you need to pick up the telephone and call the other senator. You could bar those kinds of communications because you would be, and it just would be impossible, really, to conduct the business if we cannot talk to each other. And so that's, there again, in the case you mentioned, it's a subcommittee, it has to come back to the full body, and they're obviously the ones that adopted.
I guess, if I could respond, and I'm only debating whether or not I want to adopt the roadie versus the sponsor substitute on this.
No, Madam Chair, just for clarification, I am not proposing this, just an issue that has been raised.
Oh, okay.
I am supportive of Senator Rohde's suggestion.
Okay. I like what this is suggesting to do, but I'm not too sure that it can work, because you can have those informal discussions that are not substantive discussions, and where you're sitting around saying to another member, well, let's call a subcommittee together and discuss the following items. And I'm not too sure that we would classify that as being anything other than non-substantive discussion. But the problem I have is when two members go into a room, as they do and have done for the last six or so years I've been in here, and write the budget, where they walk down through a stack of requested add-ons and deletions from everybody else and say, let's go through this, 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 and we make agreement on between the two of us, and we call in the minority member, and we sanction it in a formal session. which happens. It's real easy. I mean, that's the expedient way to do the process. Not the best way to do the process, but it does happen. So that's where it gets into a tricky
chair. Madam Chair, through the chair. The reason I would suggest going with the other committee substitute that you have is that is one that I think could be addressed in legislation. We need to make changes to the implementing legislation. It's going to be a difficult one to deal with. I'm not, and that's exactly why we had came to the conclusion that it was best out of the legislation. But it certainly is an area of abuse. There are a number of them, and we tried to confine this so that you can't drive a 10-ton truck through it.
We have other people testifying. Senator Rohde is next. Ms. Dybul, you're waiting to testify.
Yes, I am.
Are you going to speak to the subcommittee issue?
The subcommittee issue? Well, this could address it. It doesn't say subcommittee specifically, because I was not aware of this.
Okay, the reason I was asking is I was going to ask for a motion, but if maybe we should wait until after your testimony before I ask for that motion. Senator Rohde, you're next.
Going down the page, the Section E of the suggested wording says this section does not restrict discussion between two legislators. Does it then restrict discussion between three legislators? I guess that would be the legal inference that one would draw.
Madam Chair, Senator Rohde, it does if those three legislators constitute a quorum of a subcommittee or a committee, and if they are discussing the substantive merits of a piece of legislation within the jurisdiction of their committee or subcommittee. If they are not, it does not.
The reason I raise the point with as a lawyer is that what you said would be covered under the Section 24 A, mm-hmm. but if you read then Section E, one could conclude that any three legislators discussing something would be in violation. I'm not sure that E adds anything to the proposed CS, and I agree with the subcommittee portion of it, but it tends to muddy the issue because everything we want to do is encompassed in Section A, and it would be my recommendation that we not include E, because that would induce more question about what happens when you have more than two people talking about an issue, because again, the inference is there. We ought not to have inferences in constitutional amendments. They ought to be clear upon their face.
Madam Chair, if you actually, if E were removed and the and E in Section 24, I don't think that would do damage. The reason, though, E is in there is any piece of legislation such as there are pieces of proposed amendments such as this that, it, on the one hand, places limits upon the legislature in the interest of ensuring certain public rights, but the other time, on the other part of the balancing act is you want to make sure you're not grinding the legislative process to a halt. Throughout the course of this bill, one of the sort of the bedrock concerns has been that there not be something that limits the ability of two legislators to talk to each other. And it was for that reason initially that a House committee, I believe it was House Judiciary 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, took out subcommittees, because we started out with subcommittees, because they said you have a lot of three-member subcommittees, you get down to the quorum of two, and then that's two people who can't talk to each other. What this was, and this drafted, well, legal services participated in this, is a thing to say that quorums, whether they be of the House, of the committee, or the subcommittee, are prohibited from doing substantive discussion and debate on legislation under this jurisdiction down to the point where you get down to two people. And there's nothing in here that affects the right of two people to discuss. And there is also nothing that limits the right of any number of legislators to discuss something as long as it's not substantive discussion and debate on a piece of legislation under their jurisdiction at that time.
I, through the chair, I understand your intention, and I think that we may well find an artful attorney arguing the other side of the issue, diametrically opposed to what we here today understand. And the court in this state operates under the plain meaning rule, and obviously you could say the plain meaning is that three legislators are prohibited from talking.
Madam Chair, I think what's brought out just very clearly in this discussion, and it's great, is the difficulty of getting down to the subcommittee level. Many chairmen might put a bill off with two people. We have a work session, and you're not going to go through the formal process of it, but it's still the same kind of question that you run into, so it's very difficult, and that was among these, the reasons that subcommittees were not addressed, and that if possible, to be able to address that in a piece of legislation such as the one you proposed would be really an appropriate place, I think, to issue with that, deal with that issue.
Through the chair, in reviewing in some detail the Supreme Court case that required this constitutional amendment, once we establish the ability to do it, then we can, with great detail and specificity, outline what the various requirements are for open meetings and change that as time goes by to meet conditions, but not to slow down the process, as Edward Albee, the playwright, said.
The intent of this resolution to make openness in government the rule rather than in secrecy the exception. I wonder why you chose openness in government versus in the legislative process, because, of course, the public, in dealing with government, deals far more with the executive branch than they deal with us. They deal with us for 4 or 5 months of the year on constituent problems, but in a formal sense, they deal with the executive branch an awful lot, and we're not dealing with those decisions in the executive branch. It just seemed that it would be more accurate if it said openness in the legislative process versus openness in government.
We're dealing with the branch, unless the legal people can tell us there's something wrong with that. I don't see a problem. Do you see a problem me?
It's just a matter of accurately reflecting what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Halford, I don't think it's a big thing one way or the other. This is an amendment to Article 1 of the Constitution, which is the General Rights of the People section, and as opposed to being in a section dealing specifically with the amendment. All open meeting laws have dealt with all branches of government in one form or another. The only problem has been enforcement on the legislative branch, and that is what we rather specifically address in this amendment, is the enforcement against the legislative branch. But I don't think it's a big issue, so the Senator feels strongly about it.
I see what they're saying. They're saying it's in a generic section of the Constitution, so they want to keep it.
All it deals with is the legislature. Maybe it should be in the legislative section of the Constitution.
Madam Chair, Senator Halford, again, I don't think that's a big thing either. There has been some rather extensive discussion on that issue also, and there have been opinions both ways. The sort of the weight of the opinions has been that the people wanted it in the section of general rights, but again, I don't think that's an issue that's crucial to the amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd hate to send a message, though, that you didn't want those guys to be open. I think the message is good, even though you're...
No, but I don't think we're doing anything to open them up with this legislation.
We're saying they should be. Government should. No, I understand.
Well, I mean, the purpose of this amendment to Article 1 Constitution, this resolution, is to make openness in government the rule and secrecy the exception. My concern is that with the passage of this amendment, we help with regard to the legislative branch. I think openness in government is still the exception.
Senator, do you have other comments right now?
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to get to Ms. Oh, Senator Pierce, I'm sorry.
Well, I have a question that was also for Senator Rohde, but for Senator Strzelecki. On the second page of Dick Bradley's memo, the last paragraph, Ms. Bradley says, in my view, intentional exposure intends us to penalize only those who facilitate the violation. On the other hand, if you should penalize all those who participate in a closed meeting, knowing that the meeting violates open meeting requirements, willful might be better. And according to Senator Rohde, you have agreed to use the word intentional rather than willful. Reading Mr. Bradley's paragraph, I would certainly want willful left there, because the 60 of us, I think, this passes, have a responsibility to the public. The fact that you know it's illegal, but you went because somebody else called it, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't make you any less culpable. And I would believe that we all are big enough to realize if somebody calls a meeting and nobody else goes, then it's not a closed meeting. And so we should leave that responsibility to all of us, not just to somebody who supposedly calls a meeting. And I guess I'd like your discussion on why you think intentional is better than willful.
I don't have Mr. Bradley's.
Could I give that to you? Madam Chair, and then I'd be interested in Senator Rohde's remarks, but a question here of the attorneys, which very clearly, if the Supreme Court has suggested that the word is not a term of art, so then you get into the difficulty of judicial interpretation of it. And so I, there again, if intentional seems to go farther to say that it's a deliberate act, and so that, to me, the words are, to me, would mean the same. But if it means that it would be easier to have the court rule on the issue, then I think that's a more appropriate quote-unquote term of art. And Senator Rohde, can you add to that?
Just want to read just refresh my recollection the last part of the of Mr. Bradley's memorandum. My reasoning on it had nothing to do with the question of whether or not you're dealing with one person or with several. The fact of the matter is, I think they're probably going to be dealt with anyway. But the term willful, as it's used in the Alaska statutes, varies in the context. The term intentional has a very clear meaning. That has been exactly set forth by the Supreme Court. It would be theoretically possible to have a willful act. You would willfully go to a meeting, but you wouldn't know it was wrong. And you don't want to punish unintentional conduct. And that's why I prefer, for those two reasons. One, there isn't a precise enough definition to suit me of willful, and secondly, you want to get those people who intentionally do something wrong, not those people who happen to be with it and have no bad intent. That was my reason, and if the senator doesn't agree with that, certainly she can vote against the committee substitute.
Senator Pierce, please proceed.
I guess I don't see who, under your interpretation of maybe there's another artful term that means willful, not intentional, the way I read this definition. If, from what you're saying, is that the entire amendment isn't clear, and some people aren't going to know some legislators wouldn't know when they were in an illegal closed meeting. I would hope that if that's true, then we need to clarify it so that it's real clear to 60 people what is open versus what is not open. And I don't see how you can unintentionally be in a closed meeting under a clear rule.
Mr. Rohde.
You either are or you aren't.
Mr. Rohde, Mr. Christensen came up with the idea that maybe we could discuss using the word knowingly.
That's a reasonable alternative. I use the word intentionally because it has the best definition of those words that are possibilities in Alaska. And I don't necessarily agree with this opinion because if someone did it willfully, under your scenario, you could also argue, well, they intended to do it too, if they know the consequences of their action. And I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with Mr. Bradley's thought on the matter. And the great difficulty lies in the fact that the willful is not as carefully defined as any lawyer might wish.
If we could just hold this discussion to get the next testimony. It's a very good discussion, and I think we're doing a lot of work here, which I know Senator Sturgeon must be very glad about. But let's hear from the Stibles. Please, ma'am, if you would come to the table and identify yourself, and we're anxious for your testimony. I love your outfit. That's gorgeous.
My name is Kay Diebels.
Oh, Diebels.
And I live in Juneau. I feel just a little bit heretical with what I'm about to say. I'm here today to tell you, it seems to me that you're working on the open meetings issue from the wrong angle. I've served 14 years in the local level as a planning commission member and chair, and as an assembly person. More recently, I chaired the open meetings board appointed by the Juneau Assembly. I served on a federal gas and oil leasing advisory board and as chair of the first state salary commission. I've also frequently given testimony in front of decision-making bodies before, during, and since my official roles in public service. I go through this partial litany to indicate to you that I'm no stranger to public involvement, public decision-making, or to understanding the open meeting statute. My public service began long before most of the court decisions on open meetings were handed down. Even though a strong advocate of open meetings, I frequently talk to fellow members about city business over the telephone at lunch and after meetings. It never occurred to me or my colleagues that we were not complying with the open meetings law. And while I agree that sort of thing could be abused, I am confident we did not abuse the spirit of the law. We discussed problems we saw and how to approach solutions. And I'm convinced we served the public better and more completely than had we not had these get-togethers. I cannot imagine getting together with a colleague and not discussing what your common bond is and what your mind is probably consumed with. The proposed constitutional amendment is being brought forward under great pressure. That pressure is being brought because the legislature has not seen fit to abide by the open meetings restrictions it wrote into law. Every local government and every other statewide public body is required to adhere to open meetings restrictions. And in fact, when reading the statute, one would think that the legislature would also be operating that way. However, ever since the law was passed, it has appeared too stringent to most of the legislature. It's also a very different way of operating, much more difficult. Theoretically, that's the way it should be. Everything very open, with the public able to be privy to any kind of discussion having to do with the public business, because that's how solutions do begin. However, I'm not sure that's the best way. If the law is too stringent for the legislature, do not the same arguments hold for local government? I believe they do. I wonder if there is some way the present open meeting statute can be modified, which would meet the spirit of the law, but allow some freewheeling discussions on problems and possible solutions by two or more members of a body. As a member of the Open Meetings Board in Juneau, I attempted unsuccessfully to come up with some modifications to propose. What our Open Meetings Board did come up with after thoroughly reviewing court decisions was a very strict set of guidelines, which we suggested would keep Juneau's Assembly in compliance with the law. They did receive fair statewide coverage, and you may have seen that when it happened. The reason I wanted to offer suggestions for modifications was because during the Open Meeting Board study and discussion of open meeting statutes of Alaska and many other states, as well as court decisions, it became clear that, given our state's law, Alaska's courts really had no option to determine a lesser standard than the very tight standard they have adopted. And incidentally, in one of the more recent decisions, the court specifically stated that a quorum, a word you have been tossing around here, and that I note in the proposed bill, was not necessary to have an illegal gathering or discussion. They made that comment in the court decision on the Anchorage case. Pardon me? Yes. I welcome this increased focus on open meetings and open meetings legislation. I hope that from it may become a growing awareness that the existing law is too inclusive, that if the legislature feels it cannot serve the public as well by closely following the letter of the law, it may realize that local government has exactly the same problem. And that may be the impetus needed to find a compromise that both local governments and the legislature can adhere to. This exercise in trying to come up with a statute that the legislature can follow may clearly demonstrate that what is really needed is some slight change in our present open meetings law. Until the legislature is forced to consider operating in the same fashion as it has mandated for local governments, there will be no interest in loosening the standard just a trifle.
If that's the result from this focus on open meetings, our time will have been well spent. And that's the bill I'd really like to be testifying on.
Questions?
Just a question. Do you think the legislature can operate under this system?
I doubt it. I really doubt that local governments can really operate under that system.
Once it's fully developed by the courts and carried to its extreme under existing
I really doubt it. I really doubt it. As I talked about what you're full of, and these, as you're walking down the street, you want to come up with a suggestion that you thought of while you were going to sleep last night. You know, this is what I thought of could solve something. I just think it's not totally workable. Adhere to that strictly. And I guess I should go into very briefly what the most stringent guideline that the Juno board came up with for to guide the assembly, and they had some problem with this, was that the court says you don't need a quorum to be illegal. Okay, with a Juno assembly, there are 9 members, so 5 is a quorum. So if you don't have to have a quorum, then 4 could be illegal. Okay, now what's the big difference between 4 and 3? And what's the difference between 3 and 2? So we said if you want to be really clean and have no doubt, you just don't talk to any other member about anything that has to do with any city business. I feel that is, I was part of that decision that gave those guidelines. Because in looking at the court cases, I felt we could come to no other decision because our job was to guide them so that they were in compliance. I don't happen to like the decision that we came up with, because I don't think it's workable.
Senator Strickland.
Yes, I don't, Madam Chair, I don't want to get in any kind of debate, but it has been a real problem for the municipalities to operate under what is a more stringent set of rules that we have that we don't follow. I think they need amendments too, and I think that's what you're saying, that in some cases the court has prescribed the rules, and of course, under the current situation, without those amendments, all of municipalities, school boards, and all the rest can be subject to the court's interpretation and determination. The only ones that don't have to is of course, the legislature. And so I think that there's merit in the need to get into the open meeting law. We have difficulty doing that in those areas that are very volatile, but I certainly agree that the changes need to be made in the open meeting.
Mr. Campbell, you had some comments.
Madam Chairman, I can't, I guess, restrain myself from commenting briefly, both as a staff member who has worked on this and also as a member of the Juno Assembly who lives with some of these open meeting guidelines. And by the way, we didn't fully accept the recommendations. In fact, we modified them because we felt they were a little too tight. But I don't think there's any doubt that the way the courts have interpreted the existing open meetings law for municipal governments, that the legislature simply could not function under that. And quite frankly, it does have a significant effect on the efficiency of municipal governments. One of the things that I hope the legislature will consider when they deal with implementing legislation is to make a more clear, a less ambiguous law that doesn't leave such latitude for court interpretations that I feel have carried the law way beyond what was ever intended for municipal governments. I think there are very legitimately some reasons for stricter requirements on municipal governments. A, they are smaller bodies, they are unicameral bodies, and they are not political bodies, and they are nonpartisan bodies. So you don't have some of the divisions that do cause some inherent checks on the process in the legislature. But quite frankly, I think that the best chance for the legislature taking up statutes that would deal with the open meetings law as it applies to municipalities is for it to pass an open meetings amendment and therefore have the necessity of adopting and implementing legislation.
Senator Halford.
Why would a governor want to let the legislature relax the standard under which it operates after a constitutional amendment passed, which essentially made it very difficult for the legislature to deal with the executive branch?
I'm sorry, Senator, I'm
missing
the
question. I'm sorry, governor's veto power, statute, not a word.
Why would a governor who, say, is elected, say we put this on the ballot and it passes in the next election, the governor's elected, and then the legislature wants to limit the Open Meetings Act, which it finds is hamstringing itself in dealing with the executive branch, why would the governor not veto the legislation?
One of the things, if I may, is I think by simply the passage of this amendment in itself, it removes a lot of that problem. One of the things that it says is this amendment provides a basis for judicial enforcement of the existing open meetings law, and this is the important part, to the extent that those provisions are consistent with this amendment. A piece of the Constitution will always take precedent over legislation, and I think the governor would have no interest in vetoing a piece of legislation that simply implements this. But the existing open meetings law, and to the extent it's inconsistent with this amendment, could not continue not to be enforced.
Well, it can be enforced on the municipal bodies, it can't be enforced on the legislature.
Right.
But the only thing that I can see that's inconsistent is that it looks like this could never be enforced to discussions between two legislators, because that specifically is stated, and regardless of what the Open Meetings Act could be deferred down to in a municipal setting, it could never reach that far with the legislature. But what other thing is limited that's in the existing Open Meetings Act that couldn't be applied to the legislature?
And Madam Chairman, I am not in, you know, supporting that you adopt that. I think I've made that clear. But that would be one approach of handling.
We're still looking at this CS.
Yes, that's why we have not moved to CS yet. Mm-hmm. So both of them are before us for discussion. I thought that was the best way to do it.
Okay, what is limited in the current or your current proposed CS or the current bill? Where is there a limitation on the existing Open Meetings Act as it applies to municipalities?
Madam Chair, Senator Halford, if I may. I think there are several things in here. One is there have not been any specific court cases regarding the legislature and what are having to do with less than a quorum. That has never been an issue. It has been a court, there have been actually several court cases, Cahill versus Juneau regarding serial communications, Brookline versus the municipality of Anchorage regarding less than a quorum, having to do with less than a quorum. This makes it very clear that those cases would not be applicable to the legislature, that we are only dealing with quorums. Also, the existing open meetings law provides for invalidation of legislation. This makes it very clear that cannot be done. This basically would govern for the legislature. I think it would behoove the legislature to then have implemented legislation, for instance, to set the level of fines, if they wish to clarify things. But this is probably more specific than the existing piece of open meeting legislation we have. It is incredibly vague and wide open to court interpretation.
Other comments?
So the quorum is a big question that's handled. You know, essentially, you've got to get to three people with the committee structure of the legislature. You're not going to have the two-person problem. Your problem is going to start with three people.
Madam Chair, another thing that is a specific difference is this makes it very clear what the subject is for a violation. The subject has to be private and substantive discussion or debate on legislation under its jurisdiction by that quorum. In municipal court cases, that has not been the case. In, for instance, Brookline versus Municipality of Anchorage, it was simply an informational meeting.
But we're allowing the court to define what private and substantive discussion or debate is, which is a pretty broad latitude, just out of the box.
Unless, of course, you would define that in statute.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, right.
Yeah, I don't know the answer. I'm not.
Yeah, you know. No, but the point is you could anticipate. I think you would need legislation to deal with those. Whether you deal with that particular one or not, I don't know.
Ms. Diebels, you are welcome to
I was just
up here. You're at the table and
I wanted
you are
to jump
part
in
of this discussion.
Madam Chair.
That very question about this, oh, I lost my thought. It's gone. Continue. It'll come back. It'll come back.
Discussion.
The
pardon
question
me?
About
what is
yes,
the
it was
discussion.
Substantive.
Yes.
That was the word. And I think that, I feel that the court alluded to that in one of the cases, and because they were talking about discussions as sort of the beginning of the forming of opinion. And it's my, I'm no attorney, I don't know that much about law, but it's my guess that they would feel that substantive, I feel that they might define it differently than you might think of it. You might think it's substantive.
It would include information gathering.
Yes, yes. Because, in fact, that's what the Brookline case was about. I mean, it was information gathering about something that was going to be before.
A body.
The body, mm-hmm.
But it was my understanding, too, that they comment on anything that helped create the solution.
That's exactly, you're right.
Any discussion, any piece of information that helped to generate that kernel that begins focusing down to the solution or to the decision.
Chair, I believe you're right, and that's why I felt that even though you put this word substantive in there, I think it seems to me that they might indeed interpret it differently than you would interpret it as you are proposing to put it in.
We think of it as a...
It's sort of important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We also think of it in pieces, and they're thinking of it as a part of the whole.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Mr. Campbell.
Madam Chair, this is one of the things that I think would be highly appropriate to deal with in implementing legislation. I would just say, though, that we have had lots of hours of discussion, particularly on these. Legislative debate is actually a term of art defined in Masons and has a very specific meaning. Discussions and my discussions with legal services and also the other attorneys who are active in this field of law and also with a number of the judges who have decided the case, this was simply the best piece or the best wording we could come up with. What we're wrestling with here is the difference between constitutional language, which is not as specific, and statutory language. And statutory language would be the place for extensive definitions.
So for the information of the committee, those of you who are not available for the state affairs hearing, that little section, those words, were debated and thought about for hours, trying
private
to focus them.
Yeah.
You bet. Private and substantive, and discussions versus debate. And this went through several drafts, and I know Senator Porchot struggled with this with Senator Strzelczyk for a long time, and he just kind of gave up almost on it, because this is the best that committee could come up with in several hearings. They had more hearings than we've had, basically. Senator?
I've got a question then that maybe Senator Strzelczyk or Kai sat through all that, and I didn't, or maybe you know it, Madam Chair, but does it require that debate both be private and substantive? And what is private? Can you have a meeting and essentially avoid the public by going to the most public place in a restaurant and have a quorum of the people that are going to decide the budget sit down and make all the decisions and do it totally in, quote, obviously public, but very definitely private from those who would want to know what you're doing?
I think I know the answer, but I'll let Senator Strzelczyk
The answer is that if you met in a restaurant, that's still a private meeting. I mean, it
has to be posted. Noticed.
Yeah, it has to meet some standards of a public meeting, and that generally requires posting and notice.
But private discussion is a different thing than private meeting. That whole thing, that still has a lot of room.
I wish I had assigned Senator Halford to the subcommittee with Senator Rohde on this issue. I don't mean to be cutting you off at all.
We would still be discussing it.
Yes. Where is the, is there any other comment from the committee? What is the will of the committee? Yes, Senator Halford.
Well, I'll tell you what my feeling would be, and it may be terrible, but I would take out the provisions that don't allow for the invalidation of legislation, because that's the real teeth. I would leave in all the other provisions, and once it was of a magnitude that it endangered the acts that we took, as it does with local governments, then we would, I think, be forced to look at every single detail of what we do and make it absolutely right, because it would have a lot more effect.
I won't ask for a motion from you then. Senator Rohde, do you have any comments?
No comment, ma'am.
Okay. We have two proposed CSs before us. The prime sponsor prefers the one dated 3989 with Senator Rohde's changing willful to intentional listed, the subcommittee issue is not addressed in that particular committee substitute. Is there someone who will be so kind as to give me a motion?
I would move that committee substitute, Madam Chairman.
The 3989 one?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there any objection?
I would object just because of the question on the words willful versus intentional and what are we really doing?
Is there any other objection?
Well, I'll object just to deal with that then.
Okay, well, let me let Senator Pierce then finish her statement. I didn't mean to interrupt her.
I think if we're going to use the word intentional in this committee, it's going to have to define that word in some way that it is not defined the way Mr. Bradley defined it in his memo.
Mr. Christensen, would you help Senator Pierce with this, please, and tell the whole committee what you found?
Madam Chairman, the criminal law, AS 1181-900, provides definitions for states of mind, including intentional, knowing, reckless, and negligent. It does not provide a definition for willful. As Senator Rohde has noted, it is a word that does not have a very, very clear and specific meaning. The criminal law defines intentional acts as acts with respect to a result described by a provision of law defining an offense when the person's conscious objective is to cause that result.
Realistically, Madam Chairman, there is very little difference between willful and intentional.
Except intentional is defined in law and willful is not.
That is correct, and that was my main reason. And that's why I don't necessarily agree with Mr. Bradley, right. And I want to go with the clearest word that we have. I don't necessarily agree with the...
Do we have blacks?
Senator Pierce said Mr. Christensen agreed with Senator Rohde. That was two attorneys that came to the same conclusion.
I would note that I won my Supreme Court case last week, too. So
somehow put on the record that our use of the word intentional does not have the effect of only of not penalizing those people who go to a meeting, even though they might not have called it, and then throw up their hands and say, oh my goodness, I didn't do it on purpose. I think that if we take an oath to uphold the Constitution, then we ought to know what's in it, and certainly something as important as this, we have the responsibility of being able to count noses and figure out how many people are there.
If I could respond to that, as the district attorney will tell you, when people there is a presumed knowledge of the laws of the state of Alaska, and even though someone who commits a crime can't tell you what all the elements of that crime are, that is not a sufficient defense for them. And so I don't really think it would. And that's why I don't agree with Mr. Bradley. Want to get a long discussion on it, but that's why I don't agree with him, because the fact that you aren't aware of all this precise elements is not an adequate defense. It's never been an adequate defense in the state of Alaska.
Okay, we have a motion before us. We had two objections. We have two people for the motion. We need to resolve this. Senator Halford, you had an objection. You had a comment.
Well, I mean, my objection is the adoption of the CS with language that doesn't provide the real teeth of an open meetings law, which are the teeth that are provided to all other governmental units. And that is the line 19 and 20, or invalidate legislation because of a violation of this section. We're taking out the major way, number one, for an individual who's harmed to seek redress, and number two, the major threat to us to follow the rules. So I would accept the motion to adopt a CS if we deleted the last phrase after the word or on line 19.
Why don't you adopt the CS and make an amendment?
No, I would move to amend the motion. There's a difference. I would move to amend the motion.
I understand the difference.
To delete or invalidate legislation because of a violation of this section.
Discussion on his amendment to the motion.
Either way, it doesn't work.
And
still
I was so happy we had everybody here today. God, that was dumb. Where is he? All right, discussion on the... I'm opposed to the amendment to the motion.
You're opposed to making it work, huh?
I'm not so sure it makes it work. I agree with the prime sponsor's analysis that the system has to go on even though there may be some troublemakers within the system, and I think the taking away the immunity on this narrow focus is enough to get everybody really conscious and aware of what's going on here without interfering with what's happening with the people's business. So the prime sponsor convinced me with his her arguments and my fear
but
of losing
people
the
people that lose.
Please, sir, I'm developing my train of thought here.
Oh.
I just feel that the legislature has a nut. Now, see, I had this rolling really pretty until you.
You were doing very well.
I agree with the prime sponsor on that issue, Senator Rudy.
You know, your point is well taken, because the people really lose when their state government is brought to a screeching halt,
right.
when the police aren't funded, when fire departments aren't funded, when schools aren't funded. That's when the people really lose. And you can't allow a small minority of people to frustrate the will of the majority. Our country is built upon majority rule, protection of minority rights. And to cant a system any other way undermines the basic premises our system operates on. And that's why I...
Should we change the law, therefore, as it applies to all local governments? Because we've adopted exactly the opposite provision and enforced it on them.
I think the adoption of this amendment is going to force us to change the open meetings law. I think if this forces that to happen. If we don't adopt this, and the
we've
reason why I
the changed, one reason that would force us to change it.
Senator Pierce, do you have an opinion on this?
No.
Is there any more discussion on this motion?
Question.
Questions?
On the amendment?
Yes. All in favor of Senator Halford's amendment, raise your hand. All opposed?
I'm deciding. Actually, I am in favor.
Doesn't matter. Still two either way.
The main motion is the adoption of this CS. That motion fails. The amendment to the motion fails. The motion is the adoption of CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 13989. All in favor? Raise your hand. All opposed. We will bring this decision up on Tuesday. You will all have worked out all your problems. The prime sponsor has been incredibly patient with the Judiciary Committee. We will do something on Tuesday, I promise.
Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, I apologize. Do we have the people from the Judicial Council that are here? Ms. Stiebel, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Yes.
We have with us today Terry Carnes and is it Marla Greenstein? Marla Greenstein from the Judicial Council. They've traveled to be with us today. They were supposed to be with us on Tuesday, and because of the weather and all the problems with the airport, I don't know where these ladies ended up, but it wasn't Juno. So it's glad to have you with us today, and we appreciate that. I'm sure you must have enjoyed that discussion. That was a very intense discussion. Why don't you let us take, just so we have everybody here, a two-minute recess, okay? And then we'll start. We have been at it for a solid hour and a half. So the committee will recess for just 2 minutes. And Ms. Carnes, Ms. Greenstein, if you will come to the committee. Ladies, we welcome you. It's very nice to have you here, and we're looking for an overview hearing here on the Judicial Council, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Terry Carnes. I'm the Senior Staff Associate with the Judicial Council, and this is Marla Greenstein. She's the Senior Staff Attorney with the Judicial Council. And as you know, the Judicial Council is established by the Constitution to nominate people for judgeships and to do research. Those are our two constitutional responsibilities. In addition, we have the statutory responsibility of evaluating judges who are standing for retention election and doing the selection for the public defender, which operates in essentially the same way as selections for judges. And we also have responsibilities that are promulgated by court rule to which usually involve evaluating experimental court programs and also a more recent one, evaluating pro tem judges. Now Marla's going to talk briefly about our selection activities in the last year.
Okay, basically first you should all have these little booklets we put together with some background information about the things that we're going to be talking about. The first is selection, judicial selection. And we just wanted to bring you up to date on what our judicial selection activities have been over the last year. In the past year, we filled two district court vacancies, one in Fairbanks and one in Anchorage, two superior court vacancies, again, one in Fairbanks and one in Anchorage, and one public defender vacancy that was created as the result of the Anchorage Superior Court choice of Dana Faith as Superior Court judge. Currently, we are also in a judicial selection process. We are now basically reviewing the applications of 14 applicants for the Anchorage Superior Court. And it's a vacancy created by the retirement of Judge Doug Serdaley. And we are currently looking at 7 applications for the Juneau District Court. And that vacancy will be created when Judge Lynn Asper retires from the bench. What's unusual about this particular group of applicants that we're looking at now is for a long time we had a group of highly public applicants, largely from the Attorney General's Office, Public Defender Agency. And our group of applicants this time, 10 of the 14 applicants for the Anchorage Superior Court are in private practice, and 4 of the 7 applicants for the Juneau District Court are in private practice. Our procedures basically will require that the Judicial Council will now review the applications. Survey went out to the bar in the last week, soliciting certain types of information and criteria on the various applicants. We then also check bar files, both discipline files and any fee arbitrations that the attorney may have been involved in. We do credit and criminal history checks on the applicants. And we also do a follow-up personal investigation if any questions are raised as a result of the survey comments and survey results. The council will then meet May 8th in Anchorage and May 9th in Juneau to interview the applicants. And a decision is usually made the same day as the interview on the nominations to go to the governor. Recently, we made one revision to our bar survey, and that is the suitability of experience question was moved up. In previous surveys, was the last question, and people seemed to be answering it as a catch-all, whether this person should be a judge or not. So we added a question. Suitability of experience is still there, but we added an overall professional performance question to see if we get any kind of different response to the suitability of experience question. That's all I had on judicial selection. We have you answering questions on selection or let Terry go on to judicial retention activities.
Historically, has the governor, not necessarily this governor, but past governors, followed the recommendations from the Judicial Council?
The governor is required by law to choose from the nominations submitted.
How many do you submit?
2 or more.
Okay.
And we're not required, and we intentionally do not submit the names in any particular order. We submit them in alphabetical order. So when we make our nominations to the governor, we aren't suggesting that, we aren't saying this person is most highly rated. We send along the applicant's full application and a copy of the bar survey so that the governor is fully informed about what the public information is available.
Great. Please proceed.
Thank you. On judicial retention, we evaluated 17 judges in 1988. Of those judges, we found 1 unqualified and 1 was opposed by a citizens group. However, all of the judges were retained. We have included in your packet of materials under tab B several memos starting in 1984 and going to 86 and 88 that show voting patterns for judicial retention elections and also include the survey scores, the bar survey and peace and probation officer survey scores for each judge for all of those years, to give you some sense of how the judges are rated and how the votes compare for district court judges, superior court judges, and then by judicial district. There are some differences. The 3rd Judicial District typically in the past has had a lower percentage of yes votes on judges than the other districts. And typically there is a minimum of about 25% no votes on all of the judges, people who just automatically vote no on every judge. That's kind of the baseline, and then it goes from there. In 1988, the range of yes votes was from 67% to 72%. Most judges got that many yes votes. And the 2 judges, the one who was opposed and the one that the Judicial Council found unqualified, got about 57% yes votes, which indicates that if there is any degree of controversy or discussion or question about a judge's qualifications, the voters are paying attention to that, and it does affect the way in which they vote. We also looked at the level of participation in judicial elections, and we to see how many of the voters are actually voting. Of the voters who participated in the 1988 elections, 93% of them voted on a congressional seat on the House of Representatives, and 83% of them voted for Justice Burke one way or the other. So you can see that there's a fairly high level of interest in the judicial elections. It's not that, very often people say nobody knows about the judges and people don't pay any attention to these elections and they're meaningless. Well, in fact, a very large majority of the voters actually do pay attention and do vote. So I think the public does find them important. And other than that, you know, 25% that automatically votes no, people, and there is a certain percentage probably that automatically votes yes, but there's a sizable group that considers the information that's available, pays attention, and changes their vote depending on that information. So just to let you know that there is interest out there in judicial elections. This was the first year during which the statute regarding public censures of judges was in effect. That piece of legislation called for the Judicial Council to incorporate any information about public censures about judges in the voters' pamphlet material. There were no judges standing this year who had had public censures, so there was nothing published. But just to report back to you on legislation that was in effect next year, in 1990, we expect that we'll be evaluating 23 judges standing for retention. Marla has a couple of comments on issues related to the 1988 elections and possible future programs from the council.
Basically, there were there was one situation, the situation that Justice Rabinowitz found himself in and raised some campaign issues for judges. Justice Rabinowitz, if you might remember, was found qualified by the Judicial Council and, in fact, was one of the highest rated judges of the judges who evaluated. There was a last-minute negative campaign against Justice Rabinowitz, and under the code of judicial conduct that we have in the state, the judge is not allowed to campaign unless until the time there is a campaign against him. So this was a very last-minute campaign. Had no notice, had to, in a very short amount of time, raise some money and put together a campaign to respond. This raised questions that as to whether it was fair to the judge to be placed in this situation. I understand that the Bar Association is looking at that particular code provision to see if it might be able to be adjusted to allow at least some preparation and anticipation of a campaign, but right now the judge can do nothing.